Somebody else selected the topic for this evening. There's a number of persons attending the program this evening that are new practitioners of bhakti yoga, devotional service, as it's described in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12. There are stages of bhakti. Just pull the plug. That's the simple program. There we go. When persons look at the message of Bhagavad Gita, or perhaps even the lifestyle of those who are long-standing practitioners of devotional service, to such persons it may look like that's a very high attainment. And how will that be possible and practical for me or for us, our family? In the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna indicates the reason for presenting this chapter particularly is that Krishna presents a range of activities that one can do that can gradually bring one to that position of elevated, very focused, very singular devotion to the personality of Godhead. And he presents the highest platform and indicates if that's not possible, then perhaps this next stage, and if that's not possible, perhaps this next stage, and so on. And then gradually shows how each successive stage can build to the topmost stage. So that's the centerpiece of this chapter 12. I'm going to do a quick overview, starting with how this topic is introduced. That's introduced through chapter 11. Chapter 11 is the universal form. In the beginning of chapter 11, Bhagavad Gita, Arjun asks Krishna, would it be possible for you to show me that form of yours that manifests the entire cosmic manifestation at once? If you give me the divine eyes, perhaps I can see that form. So Krishna gives him the divine eyes to see that form, discloses the form. Arjun describes what he sees, and he's so overwhelmed. I mean, even to describe it, but to speak of experiencing it, it's essentially, it's experiencing everything that exists in all directions of time and space, past, present, and future, and everything that exists and will exist and has existed in one place at one time. It's overload. One can't even think that, what to speak of, have such an experience. But Arjuna has that experience, the universal form. So he's feeling afraid of that fierce form, because it's the devouring agent of all of creation. It generates all of creation and destroys all of creation, this universal form. So he asks Krishna to withdraw that form and show his original form. And so Krishna withdraws the universal form and shows his four-armed form, and shows his two-armed form. Then he concludes the chapter by saying that not only with divine eyes only can one see the universal form, but an ordinary person cannot properly see even this two-armed form. It's only by devotional service that I can be understood as I am. So with that concluding remark or statement, Arjuna then asks another question. So the question that he asks is, which do you recommend? Devotional service, trying to understand you through devotional service, or trying to understand you through meditation upon your impersonal feature, a more extended presentation of this is, in a different form, Arjuna has already asked this question twice. He asked this question at the beginning of chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 5. The form of the question is different. The question Arjuna has asked is more about process rather than the object of meditation. The process, Arjuna has raised the doubt, why do you recommend that I engage in this ghastly warfare when you say that knowledge is better than fruitive work? Because Krishna said both. Knowledge is better than fruitive work. But as far as Arjuna is concerned, the duty that he has as a Kshatriya to enter onto the battlefield and fight against his relatives, etc., 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 to him appears to be ghastly fruitive work. And why is it that Krishna is asking that when he's already said knowledge is better than fruitive work? The difficulty is Arjuna is not understanding the nature of devotional service. Devotional service is not fruitive work. Work in devotion frees one from the whole spirit and the consequence of fruitive work, or is akarma, free from karma. There's vikarma, forbidden activity, there's karma, there's prescribed activity, and there's akarma, activity that has no reaction. In devotional service, Krishna has explained, chapter 3, chapter 5, now again, he's going to explain chapter 12 very explicitly about the distinction between meditation upon the impersonal and the personal feature. The summary is, there are two main reasons why Krishna indicates devotional service is better. One of them is, it's natural, as opposed to very unnatural. Because it's natural, it's very easily performed. And that which is unnatural is very, very difficult to perform. And ends up afterwards, after long, 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 many lifetimes of endeavoring, one may come to the point of reaching the same position as the natural position. Prabhupada gives this example. If someone was asked to touch their nose, there's two ways to do it. You can touch your nose, or you can reach your head around your arm around the back of your head and touch your nose. In either case, you're touching your nose. But there's a difficult, because it's indirect, and there's a direct. But the end result is, touch your nose. So the same, the long-standing process of many, many, many lifetimes, bahunam, janmanam, ante, gyanavan, Maam Prapadyate. At the end of many, many lifetimes of Gyan, one who achieves the culmination of that, may or may not, but if they achieve the culmination of that, then they surrender unto Krishna. Understanding Vasudev Sarvamiti, Krishna is everything. Samahatma Sudurlabha. That's such a great soul. It's very rare to find one who follows the path of Gyan and ends up understanding that Krishna is everything and surrenders unto Krishna. It's not easy to touch your nose, wrapping your hand, your armor on your back. It's possible. Well, practice, and you can, it can be done. But this is much easier. Just directly surrender to Krishna. So it's easier. The process of devotional service is natural, direct, much more easily performed. And the second factor Krishna presents is because he offers his direct assistance to those who surrender unto him, because they want his direct assistance. Those that don't want Krishna's direct assistance, it's on their own. So here's a simple way of saying that. Which is a better choice? Your effort or your effort plus Krishna? It's an easy choice. Krishna extends his special effort to assist those who are calling upon him in devotion. Because they want his assistance, he offers his assistance. So it's recommended, the process of devotional service, compared to the process of meditation upon the impersonal feature. Process of meditation on the impersonal feature is very difficult, and it takes many, many lifetimes. If one endures steadfastly for many, many lifetimes, one may come to the same position of finally surrendering unto Krishna. Then the second section is this. So now that Krishna has said devotional service is best, he describes what that devotional service is. And he describes it as mind fixed upon me, intelligence fully engaged in my service. Very simple. In theory, mind engaged upon Krishna, intelligence engaged in his service. In such a state, one abides with me always and attains my abode without a doubt. But supposing someone can't do that, then there's a next lower, next lower, next lower, next lower. We'll cover them. The essence of each of the lower stages is recognizing what the ultimate attainment is and acting according to one's capacity at whatever level one is, recognizing ultimately I'd like to attain this perfection or culmination of the yoga ladder, the yoga process. And then the concluding section of chapter 12 is Krishna describing when he sees, this is very confidential, when he sees such devotion within the heart of the devotee, he decorates them with nice qualities. And when he decorates them with nice qualities and they come before Krishna with those nice qualities, he's very pleased. I'll say the same thing in a slightly different way. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, there's a specific list of qualities, 26 qualities of a devotee. And of those 26 qualities of a devotee, one of those qualities is Swarup Lakshana. And the other 25 are Tatastha Lakshana. Swarup Lakshana, the principal quality, is Krishna Eka Sharana. Krishna Eka Sharana means that Krishna is the only shelter. And when one takes full shelter in Krishna, they want to come before Krishna in such a way that Krishna will smile. Krishna will be pleased. Krishna will be happy. And so what does Krishna do? He reciprocates with his devotee and begins decorating his devotee with qualities. And in course of time, the devotee becomes so nicely decorated that they exhibit all nice qualities. But where do those nice qualities come from? From Krishna. What Krishna is describing in the last part of chapter 12 is how pleased he is when he sees these qualities in his devotee. But he's the source of the qualities. His happiness is the happiness of the devotee. And the devotee's happiness is the happiness of Krishna. What it means is a loving relationship. In a true loving relationship, the happiness of the lover is the happiness of the beloved. But the happiness of the beloved is the happiness of the lover. And that's a loving relationship. Funny, this is coming to my mind. You remember in high school we were, if for English class, one English class, I think it was ninth grade, we're reading short stories. And one of the short stories was a story about, you know, a young man and a young woman, and he loved her and she loved him, so he was thinking, I want to get something for my beloved. So I can't even remember the detail, but something that he valued very much, he sold it so that he could get some ring or something for binding his beloved's hair. And she loved her friend, her boyfriend or husband or whatever, male friend, so much that she wanted to give him something that would be very meaningful for him. But she didn't have the resource, so she cut her hair and sold her hair to get something that would enhance that thing that he sold to get her something to bind her hair. Something like that. So, as simple as it is, the idyllic state of simply wishing to see the happiness, there's in Sanskrit there are the terms Vishaya and Ashraya. Ashraya is the abode of love, or the one who is feeling love towards another, and Vishaya is the object of that love. And in a true loving relationship, there is the Krishna is the Vishaya for us. He is the cenozure. He's the center of our wish to see that he is pleased. But the Krishna's loving nature is, when he sees that disposition of heart towards him, he becomes captivated. He who is supremely independent becomes captivated by the love of his devotee and places himself at the disposal of his devotee. We find this in the life of Maharaj Ambarish. I won't spend a lot of time, but it's a very beautiful section of Srimad Bhagavatam in the 8th canto, where Durvasa Muni becomes angry with Maharaj Ambarish. You know this story? Maharaj Ambarish is a great king. So, and a great devotee. So he decides, for the welfare of his citizens, he'll undergo a particular vrata, an ekadasi vrata, very severe ekadasi vrata for 1 year. And at the end of that final year of his vrata, he's to break the fast on the Dwadasi day. And just when it's time to break the fast, who arrives in the royal palace but Durvasa Muni and his 60,000 followers? So Maharaj Ambarish is very happy because he wants the honor of having the fast broken first done by Durvasa Muni, because he's been fasting also. So he requests Durvasa Muni appropriately, please break the fast first. Durvasa Muni is very pleased. So I'll be happy to break the fast first, but I've been traveling, so I have to go take my bath in the river Jamuna and perform my morning duties. I'll go quickly and come back. But as he's performing his morning duties in the river Jamuna, time is passing. They have to break the fast at the right time, or the whole vrata is not of value. The value is lost. So Ambarish Maharaj is advised by his brahmanas, if you performed abhishek of your deity this morning, he was a Krishna bhakta, you've worshipped your Krishna deity very nicely, you have some abhishek water, take a few drops of abhishek water in the palm of your hand and sip it. And then you've broken the fast, but technically it's not breaking the fast also. Brahmins are very clever. They know how to do those things. So he followed the instructions of the brahmanas. But there was another brahmana named Durvasa that had this clairvoyance. He knew that that Ambarish Maharaj broke the fast. So, and he came in a different spirit, the angry Durvasa, the easily angered partial incarnation of Lord Shiva, Durvasa Muni, came and threw a little Durvasa tantrum right in the palace and said, "You're a big offender. You invited me to break the fast first, and now you've broken the fast yourself. I curse you." And he uttered a mantra and took some pieces of hair from his head and dashed them to the ground and created a fiery demon and indicated to the fiery demon, "Kill him. He broke the fast first." Even though he didn't. He didn't. And he was following the instructions of brahmanas. So the fiery demon went charging at that Ambarish Maharaj. But Ambarish Maharaj was protected by Lord Vishnu. So the Sudarshan Chakra of Lord Vishnu came and destroyed the fiery demon. And after the fiery demon was destroyed, the Sudarshan Chakra turned at Durvasa Muni and started pursuing Durvasa Muni. So Durvasa Muni fled. But everywhere he went, Sudarshan pursued him. And so I'm cutting short a lot of the details, but he went to Lord Brahma, who said, "Durvasa, I'm a devotee of Lord Vishnu. I can't contradict something that Lord Vishnu has done. Go to Lord Shiva." He went to Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva said the same thing. "All my powers are derived from Lord Vishnu. How can I use my powers against the will of Lord Vishnu? You have to go to Lord Vishnu." So he went to the abode of Lord Vishnu. Durvasa is very powerful. Who can just like go to the abode of Lord Vishnu? Durvasa went, fell at the feet of Lord Vishnu, saying, "I've made this big offense. I had no understanding of who Ambarish Maharaj was. I didn't understand he was so dear to you. I've made a big offense. Please forgive me. And the Sudarshan Chakra, can you withdraw its power? I'm about burned to pieces." And Maharaj Ambarish heard from Lord Vishnu, "I can't do anything independent of my devotee." Now, he can do anything he wants independent of anybody because he's the supreme independent. But he said, "Because within the heart of my devotee, there's nothing but me. Please know that in my heart, there's nothing but them." Like a description of pure loving relation. "Because they know nothing but me, I know nothing but them. My pure devotees are my master." So if Ambarish Maharaj says, "Okay, withdraw Sudarshan Chakra," it's withdrawn. But I have no independent power. He has independent power. But he submitted that independent power unto his devotee at the devotee's discretion. And so the pure devotee becomes very powerful, as in some cases as powerful as the Supreme Lord, because they're invested with powers of the Supreme Lord. They're not the Supreme Lord. A jiva, a tiny living entity, should never be thought of. It's an offense to think of the jiva as equal to and or independent from Lord Vishnu. But Lord Vishnu invests powers sometimes in a jiva. The term is called Shakti Avesh. Shakti Avesh, invested with Shakti, the power of Lord Vishnu, although just a jiva. He acts like Lord Vishnu. So a pure devotee acts like that. A pure devotee becomes decorated by qualities of Krishna that come from Krishna, and Krishna becomes pleased. And it all starts with this one quality, Krishna Eka Sharana. Complete shelter, Sharana. Complete shelter in the personality of Godhead. So, the reason I thought of speaking about this chapter is particularly the middle verses. So, there's an audio portion of this. There's a narrator reciting the verses of chapter 12, so you can follow along. And we'll go back afterwards and review one more time these stages of bhakti. And I hope the sound system works.
To protect innocent people from imposters, Arjuna asked Krishna to prove his divinity by exhibiting his universal form, a form that anyone who claims to be God should be prepared to show. Krishna gives Arjuna divine vision by which to see the brilliant, glaring, unlimited universal form, which reveals in one place everything that ever was, or now is, or will be.
There's supposed to be some background music, too. So hang on, I'm going to escape and see what happens. No?
Krishna gives Arjuna.
At that time, Arjuna could see in the universal form of the Lord the unlimited expansions of the universe situated in one place, although divided into many, many thousands.
Arjuna offers obeisances with folded hands and glorifies the Lord. Arjuna requests Krishna to withdraw his fearful form and show his original form. The Lord then exhibits his forearm form and at last his original two-arm form. Upon seeing the Lord's beautiful human-like form, Arjuna becomes pacified. Only one engaged in pure devotional service can see such a form.
So that's the prelude to chapter 12, this concluding understanding that Krishna declares only one engaged in pure devotional service can see his original form. And so that prompts Arjuna to ask about devotional service.
Chapter 12, Devotional Service.
So, as mentioned, there are these three sections. And the question is very, very explicit, very clear. Arjuna wants to know, which is superior? Which does Krishna recommend? Personal worship or impersonal?
Arjuna inquired, which are considered to be more perfect? Those who are always properly engaged in your devotional service, or those who worship the impersonal Brahman, the unmanifested?
Question is very clear. So is the answer.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, those who fix their minds on my personal form and are always engaged in worshipping me with great and transcendental faith are considered by me to be most perfect.
So if that's the case, what's the next situation, the alternative?
With those who fully worship the unmanifested, that which lies beyond the perception of the senses, the all-pervading, inconceivable, unchanging, fixed, and immovable, the impersonal conception of the absolute truth, By controlling the various senses and being equally disposed to everyone, such persons, engaged in the welfare of all, at last achieve me.
They at last achieve Krishna because to achieve Krishna requires surrender unto Krishna. And they do so after understanding previous chapter of Bhagavad Gita explains they've eventually understood that Krishna is everything and so they surrender unto Krishna, so they achieve Krishna.
For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied.
And that applies to everybody. We're embodied. And while embodied, fixing your mind upon that which has no form, has no qualities, has no personality, all pervasive, fixed and immovable, even just like to think about it for a second, what to speak of thinking about it fixed of mind. Very difficult. So that's one of the reasons the bhakti process is natural and direct.
But those who worship me, giving up all their activities unto me, and being devoted to me without deviation. Engaged in devotional service and always meditating upon me, having fixed their minds upon me, O son of Pritha. For them, I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of birth and death.
And that's the second reason, the Krishna factor. Krishna personally intervenes in the efforts of those who are depending upon him to deliver them from material existence. This is an example of Ajamila. When Ajamila was calling for his son, Narayana, in the course of calling for his son, he also remembered the Supreme Lord Narayan. And when he remembered the Supreme Lord Narayan calling upon him in complete helplessness, the Yamadutas were stopped by the Vishnudutas. And he was delivered. So those are the comparison between the two, personal and impersonal worship. Now comes the stages of devotion. Krishna is going to begin with the topmost stage.
Just fix your mind upon me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And engage all your intelligence in me. Thus, you will live in me always, without a doubt.
Very simple. Just fix your mind upon Krishna. And engage all your intelligence in him, always. And by doing so, you'll live in Krishna, always. But some persons might say, you may say it's easy, but I can't do that so easily. What should I do? Krishna provides a means for those who can't stay fixed in that consciousness.
My dear Arjuna, O winner of wealth, if you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation, then follow the regulative principles of Bhakti Yoga.
Okay.
In this way, burn the desire to attain me.
Does it work, Mukunda? The picture was, one of the pictures was our mridanga player over there playing harmonium. A little younger.
In this way, develop a desire to attain me.
So there are standards for devotional practice, or called the regular principles of devotional service. And if one carefully follows those regular principles, regular practices of devotion, it works. It cleanses the heart and awakens a strong attraction so that for Krishna, so that one's mind can become fixed upon Krishna and one's intelligence always engaged in him, in his service. But somebody may look at those regulative activities of devotional service and think, whoa, I don't know if I can do them. So very mercifully, Krishna provides another step that can help bring one to that position.
If you cannot practice the regulations of Bhakti Yoga, then just try to work for me, because by working for me, you will come to the perfect stage.
So this working for Krishna, this is Karma Yoga. And a nice example is just shown in the picture. Someone may come to Krishna's temple and they like to do some service. Maybe they like to rake the leaves, or maybe they like to clean the floor, or serve out the prasadam, or clean the pots, or just do some little simple service because they like to serve at Krishna's temple. There's this nice man in our New Jersey congregation that reminds me very much of this principle. He is a landscaper. He's not really good at chanting, and you know, he likes prasadam, but you know, the regulations of bhakti yoga is not really his life and soul, but he really likes, he has his profession, but he likes doing landscaping at the temple. So he's not just cut the lawn, he'll do, you know, nice projects for beautification of Krishna's property. He likes it, and the devotees like him very much. Not just, oh, he does a good job, but you know, his demeanor is very nice. So he's engaging in this activity. And by regularly cultivating doing something for Krishna, activity for Krishna, working for Krishna, gradually that landscaper will come to the position of wanting to chant and wanting to worship and wanting to follow the other activities of bhakti. He does come to Arti. He likes to come to Arti. He likes the kirtan and the singing. And gradually, the activities of bhakti will become more and more part of his life. And then from that position of the activities of bhakti, purification, so that one's mind and intelligence becomes fixed in Krishna. But supposing someone says, oh, I don't know if I can do that. Work for Krishna.
If, however, you are unable to work in this consciousness of me, then try to act, giving up all results of your work, and try to be self-situated.
So, this goes to chapter 3, Bhagavad Gita, where karma palatyag. One is advised to give up the fruits of one's work to some charitable cause. To think that this, by this charitable work, something good will be done. And to become in that state of detachment from the fruit of work, to become conscious of the self and be situated in the self, in the Atma, in the transcendental self. Now, in this world today, this idea, at least the one on the right-hand side, is what people think religion should be doing. And it really doesn't go too much to the self-situated side. And it doesn't really go much to the working for Krishna, what to speak of regulations of bhakti. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is very clear. This one on the right is not the essence of what pure devotion, the ability that allows one, or the quality that allows one to understand Krishna, which is the goal, to understand Krishna. But if that's what one can do, that's good. And while doing that, become self-situated. Try to become detached from the worldliness of life and understand the higher nature of the self within. Supposing someone says, I appreciate that, that's very nice, but it's hard for me to stay fixed in that activity. So Krishna provides yet another lower rung.
If you cannot take to this practice, then engage yourself in the cultivation of knowledge.
Now here, this cultivation of knowledge doesn't mean going to school and college. It means study of the Vedas. Because through study of the Vedas, there's direct contact with Brahman and understanding of Brahman. How can you become self-situated if you don't have at least a conceptual notion of what Brahman is or what the self is? So, cultivation of knowledge. But cultivation of knowledge, note that cultivation of knowledge higher than that is this detached work. And then working for Krishna, and then from Krishna's perspective.
Better than knowledge, however, is meditation.
In that state of knowledge, fixing the mind on that conception.
And better than meditation is renunciation of the fruits of action, for by such renunciation one can attain peace of mind.
So this renunciation of fruits of work, it's explicit. Better than just study, and study stops there. Or study and then meditate upon that which you've studied, and it stops there. But practical activity, practical sacrifice unto the Supreme. The picture shows King Ranti Dev, and in the Srimad Bhagavatam is a very wonderful description. King Ranti Dev, like Ambarish Maharaj, Ranti Dev was a very great king and a very great devotee. And the particular quality of Ranti Dev that was noted was he was very charitable. Regularly he would provide in sacrifice. He would provide for others who didn't have requirements, basic requirements of life. He was very magnanimous in that way. He was also known for engaging in austerities. As Ambarish engaged in a Ekadasi Vrata, Ranti Dev engaged in an extended fast, and I forget the number of days, 100 days or some long fast. And he's the king. What's the king need to undergo fasting for? It was for the merit of his citizens, because when a king accrues piety, then one-sixth of the piety of the king goes to the citizens. So he wanted to benefit the citizens. So he underwent this extended fast. And the morning, when the fast was to be broken, they prepared a royal feast for the king. And so he was seated, ready to begin the fast, when just as he was about to begin, a brahmana entered into the chamber and was asking for charity. So immediately Ranti Dev got off his throne, seated the brahmana on the throne, worshipped the brahmana, and offered all of what he was to take to the Brahmana. The Brahmana accepted half and left the other half for the king. So then he was about to break his fast with the other half, and in came a pauper, a beggar, a poor man. And the poor man was asking for some charity. So Ranti Dev gave everything, the other half, to the poor man. And he's been fasting for 100 days. He's the king. But he gave to the poor man. But there was some water left. So he's about to break the fast drinking water. And another man came with some dogs. And the dogs had puppies. And he said, "My puppies are thirsty. Can I have something to drink?" So he gave even the water to the puppies. And immediately, those same personalities, the Brahmana and the pauper and the man with the puppies, disclosed that they were Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva and Lord Indra, who had come just to examine the charitable nature. They had heard of the charitable nature of Ranti Dev, and they offered him any benediction that he wanted. "You pleased us so much. Any benediction you would like." And the only benediction he wanted was the well-being of his citizens, because he was such a magnanimous, charitable king. So when one engages in sacrifice of the fruits of one's activities, which can be elevated further and further stages, directly engaging in work for the satisfaction of the Supreme, following the regulations of bhakti for pleasing the Supreme, fixing one's mind and intelligence completely upon the Supreme, these are all acts that are very pleasing and bring one to the highest platform. And when one comes to that highest platform,
in the topmost stage of devotional service, one's consciousness is totally fixed on Krishna. A step lower is the practice of regulative devotional service. Lower than that is karma yoga, renouncing the fruits of action. Indirect processes for attaining the Supreme include meditation and cultivating knowledge.
So we'll review this. Largely, this meditation and cultivation of knowledge is what some people are pursuing. Meditation and yoga are becoming trendy in the West, popular. And some persons, they like to read about the Upanishads or something from the Vedas and get a little knowledge beyond their limited sphere. So each of these bring purification, peace, gradual elevation. That elevation manifests when there is work for Krishna. The fruits of one's work are offered to Krishna. Or even better, one directly just works for Krishna. And when that advances, then coming to the stage of wanting to follow the regulations of bhakti, yoga, awaken. And through that, a desire to attain to Krishna awakens. And when a desire to attain to Krishna awakens, mind becomes fixed and intelligence absorbed in serving him, and one attains Krishna's association. This is these steps or sequences of devotion that Krishna has described in this chapter. So the conclusion of the chapter is very nice and very confidential. When Krishna sees this devotion, he decorates his devotees and shows how he is pleased by them. Just like Sudama, a very beautiful painting. Sudama was a friend of Krishna in school. They went to the same Sandipani Muni school. And in their childhood, they developed a fast friendship, deep love for one another. When they grew up, Krishna became the prince of Dwarka, and Sudama became a poor Brahmin, but a pure Brahmin, pure Vaishnava, pure devotee of Krishna. So although their position is the Brahmin is being respected by Krishna, and Sudama has come to Krishna to accept some charity, but the essence of their exchange is not, you know, receiving and giving of charity. It's the exchange of love. Tears are coming from Krishna's eyes, and tears are coming from Sudama's eyes, just to be in that relationship, intimate relationship with one another. This makes one very dear to Krishna. And such nice qualities were Sudama's qualities also. Without good qualifications, pure devotion isn't manifest. But one who is not a devotee doesn't have those good qualifications.
One who is not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities. Whoa.
This is Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the Jharkhand forest, where his associate was very worried about Lord Chaitanya's dancing and chanting with all the wild animals. But because Lord Chaitanya was not envious towards any of the living entities, their envy towards are natural and inimical position. Here's a tiger embracing the deer. Dancing. Their natural enmity was given up by spiritual influence of Lord Chaitanya. And here's another example. This is Narada and his friend Parvat Muni. When Narada first visited Magari the hunter, his occupation was killing animals, half dead hunter. But through Narada's association, he gave up that profession and became a devotee of the Lord. Now when Narada came back to visit him, he's unwilling to even step on an ant. So he took his upper garment and very carefully was brushing aside the ants so he could run to greet Narada. This is his cottage by the side of the river and his little tulsi plant where he would do his chanting.
Who does not think himself a proprietor and is free from false ego.
This is King Pratap Rudra, who at the time of Jagannath Rath Yatra took a broom, golden-handled broom because he's a king, but a broom and swept the road before Lord Jagannath, took a very humble position, not thinking himself, I'm big king, someone else can sweep the road. But as a servant of Lord Jagannath, he swept the road. And because of that, Lord Chaitanya gave him his mercy.
Who is equal in both happiness and distress. Who is tolerant, always satisfied.
This is Maharaj Prikshit being bitten by this poisonous serpent, snake bird, that was the curse of this Sringi, the Brahmana's son who was offended. And he was, after hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, his consciousness was so fixed, he knew the snake bird was coming, but he was remaining undisturbed through that difficult situation.
Self-controlled and engaged in devotional service with determination, his mind and intelligence fixed on me.
There we are again, mind and intelligence fixed on me.
Such a devotee of mine is very dear to me.
Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad. So we're going to hear some glories of Prahlad Maharaj.
He for whom no one is put into difficulty.
Prahlad was put into difficulty, but he was not putting others into difficulty.
And who is not disturbed by anyone. Who is equipoised in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety. Is very dear to me.
And then, Hanuman.
My devotee who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, who is pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, and not striving for some result, is very dear to me. Those who follow this imperishable path of devotional service and who completely engage themselves with faith, making me the supreme goal, are very, very dear to me.
End of chapter. That's the aspiration of a devotee. There's no greater aspiration for a devotee than somehow becoming dear to Krishna. How does one become dear to Krishna? When Krishna becomes dear to you. And we just heard some nice description of when challenges come, life throws many challenges our way. Things, outcomes don't come out the way that we had anticipated those outcomes would come out. But one tolerates and is patient and all these nice qualities, where do you get these nice qualities? From Krishna. Krishna endows one with those capacities to look at the reversals of life or the parade of ups and downs of life. The ever-changing kaleidoscope of life with a fixed state of consciousness fixed upon Krishna. That decoration pleases Krishna very much. So, it's sometimes asked, we'll just end with this, it's sometimes asked, as practicing devotees, are we supposed to try and cultivate these qualities, or do we just like wait until Krishna decorates us with these qualities? Because it seems if we're trying to acquire a certain quality, looks fruitive, like I'm trying to get this or I'm trying to get that. So the Prabhupada supplies the answer in a one purport in the Bhagavad Gita, where he explains first and foremost is the desire to please Krishna. Following behind that desire to please Krishna, we would like to please Krishna in this way, we'd like to please Krishna in that way, we'd like to please Krishna in so many different ways. With and following behind that desire to please Krishna, we should strive for equanimity, tolerance, happiness in all circumstances, and so on. And then Krishna, seeing that particular aspiration for in our cultivation, let's say to be tolerant, there's some trying circumstance and you remain tolerant, Krishna is very pleased. Krishna strengthens that effort to be tolerant by granting you with tolerance, and so on. Krishna decorates one, rewards one who is striving to please him, not independently have some kind of capacity that's unique and will gain you some honor or distinction or something like that. But for the purpose of pleasing Krishna, Krishna then decorates his devotees with these nice qualities. And that's the path of bhakti. So now we'll just go back very quickly to this Actually, it's the end of the prior section. We'll go this way. Yeah. This is the key to the chapter, the heart of the chapter. These stages of devotion. If one is not on the staircase at all, get on the staircase. If one is at this stage of the staircase, cultivate that very nicely. One shouldn't be anxious or competitive or something. Work within your capacity to develop, according to the indications that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita, how to develop these. And by developing these, it is good to know where the staircase is going to take you. What's on the top step? Why even get on the staircase to begin with? There's something, a state of consciousness that Krishna is advocating. And that state, so if we're not envious or inimical towards that higher state of consciousness, then gradually, recognizing what that higher consciousness is, Krishna will help us go to the next stage, It should be gradual and natural. If one follows that process, then it's the example is given in Nectar Devotion, like the capacity for a child to walk. When there's a little pre-toddler child just crawling, the child just naturally learns to walk. The parents usually help the child to learn to walk. And they take in a little wobbly step, and then their legs crumble and they're crashed to the ground. So what should they do? They get back up again and try the next step, and crash again, and get up again and try the next step. And after some time, they're walking. And after some walking, they're running. And after some running, they don't stop running. It's go, 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 go. Because the walking capacity or propensity is there in the child. It comes out gradually. Similarly, the state of pure devotion, of being connected to God in love, is natural for the living entity. And so that awakening of that natural tendency manifests itself in different stages. In human behavior, these meditation and cultivation of knowledge, being charitable and being situated in the self, working for Krishna, being detached from the fruits of one's work, or working directly for Krishna, following the regulations of bhakti, being fixed in consciousness upon Krishna. That's the natural state, and in progressive stages it awakens. And when that gradual progression is moved along, then our understanding of Krishna, our ability to clearly understand who Krishna is, with the nice assistance of the message of Bhagavad Gita, naturally, but it unfolds, like the ability of a child to walk. It naturally arises because it's dormant, it's within. And by practice. So within the bhakti process, there's also very simple practices, like we've been doing before we started this chanting. It's very natural. I've seen in so many different arenas where small children that never heard chanting before, they hear chanting and they clap, they smile, they dance, just naturally so. It's from my own experience as a young American growing up, where I never had heard Krishna's name before, but just by hearing Krishna's name, it was a natural attraction. And even if it's not in the language at all, in Chinese, there are Chinese devotees that they never heard Krishna before, and now they're devoting their life to Krishna. And how is it possible? Because Krishna bhakti is within. And by hearing Krishna's name and receiving the message of Krishna and receiving the remnants of food offered to Krishna and so on, by following these vidhis of sadhana bhakti, that devotion to Krishna awakens, because it's dormant, it's within. And in its mature stage, it's this one, mind fixed upon Krishna. Intelligence always engaged in how to best serve Krishna. It's natural. It comes in course of time. So it's a very nice chapter, a very important chapter in Bhagavad Gita. And I thought to share it with you. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? You can turn the light on. Can we turn this thing off? Anyone like to comment or raise a question? Yes.
I had been reading Bhagavad Gita so many times, even this 12th chapter, translation, everything. It never becomes so clear, you explained in such a way. I don't know how it happens. It's so great. This is my comment. A hundred times I read, I translate, but nothing fixes so clear. She's so clear, Maharaj. Thank you very much.
I don't know what to say.
I cannot stop it.
Okay. I didn't make the PowerPoint, somebody else did.
You presented it.
Okay. Okay. I pushed the button. Yes.
Maharaj, the stages of devotion that you were showing, at least in my case, day-to-day life, it seems like there is not one stage that I'm fixed in.
That's right.
Cultivating knowledge at the same time, trying to practice to work for Krishna at the same time, trying to follow, if not all the regulative principles of devotional service, at least the regulative principles, the four main regulative principles. So it seems like in all
there's an overlap.
It's overlap.
Okay, two things. These are not intended. It would be a mistake to think of these being like buckets. You're either in this bucket or that bucket or that bucket. It's a continuum, and for analysis convenience sake, they're broken up. But one can be partly over here and partly over there, or a span over. Second point is, when we're reading Bhagavad Gita, it's not the same as that bottom stage of cultivation of knowledge. If the consciousness is, I wish to understand Krishna, and I wish with that understanding of Krishna to serve him better, then it becomes bhakti. It becomes a regulation of bhakti. It's that third step, because shravanam kirtanam, Vishnu smaranam, you're engaging in directly in a process of bhakti. So that which is at the bottom step is, one does not know about bhakti, one is just reading books to speculate and scratch one's head and pull one's chin and try to figure it out of, what's supreme, what's going on here, what is Brahman. Neti neti. And so on. So while the activities that we're engaged in may, in practicing bhakti, may look like the activities that a worldly person engages in, like going to the office or eating your meals or cleansing your body or, something, paying your mortgage or whatever the things are that people do. The distinction on this yoga ladder is consciousness, the doing that for Krishna. For the pleasure of Krishna. Yeah?
Maharaj. Maharaj, you mentioned the two different kinds of lakshanas, Swarup Lakshana and Tathastha Lakshana.
Yeah.
Is this, what is the significance of Tathastha Lakshana? Does it help us get towards the Swarup Lakshana, or is there something else?
It's insubstantial without the Swarup. It will. It's ephemeral. It's insubstantial. It's not enduring. It's here one moment and gone the next moment. So, and therefore, it's not a real quality. It's illusion, or it's a product of the material energy. It may be the product of the quality of goodness, but the quality of goodness is also flickering. It's there one moment and gone the next. As opposed to like the qualities that we saw of Hanuman or Prahlad or Dhruva, it's not circumstantially generated, and therefore it's not circumstantially withdrawn. It's a quality, a spiritually based quality. Anything else? Yes?
The different stages which we discussed, and that working for Krishna, is that same as Karma Yoga?
Yes.
And meditation is same as Dhyan Yoga?
Not exactly. The not exactly. Just meditation. Like, you know, Patrick, the fellow that does this meditation. Now he's doing some meditation. Not Dhyan Yoga, it's meditation. He's freeing his, you know, he relaxes all the muscles, he like emphasized all, every last muscle in the body. I don't know how you becomes relaxed. And then the mind becomes concentrated and he was, you know, doing his thing and turn his attention inward. I don't know what, you know, where you go from there. But, so that's a kind of meditation. That makes, for him, feel that's like, that's his sadhana, his meditation. So detached from outward and turning inward. Towards what? He's, you know, still, that's yet undefined, but that's a type of meditation. So your question is Dhyan Yoga below Gyan Yoga or below Karma Yoga?
No. How about the meditation on the form of Krishna?
That sounds like bhakti to me.
Yeah.
Manmana, right?
Okay.
Rajiv, you had something? No. Okay. Okay. Yes.
Maharaj, sometimes while practicing devotional service, the modes of nature act.
No. Go ahead.
Like we are trying to do devotional service and modes of nature acts. So how can we check that this mode of nature?
By becoming pure. There's a In the third canto of Bhagavatam is Sankhya Yoga taught by Lord Kapila to Devahuti. And the process, understanding the fundamental principles of material nature and understanding of devotional service. So Devahuti asks Kapila Dev, devotional service is pure. Is it possible for devotional service to be mixed with the modes of nature? And his answer immediately is yes. And he describes devotional service that's mixed or influenced by the mode of ignorance, the mode of passion, the mode of goodness, and then pure devotional service. And he describes the characteristics of each. So how does it go from devotional service is mixed to devotional service is unmixed? It's by purification. By correctly applying and effectively applying one's attention on the Supreme, because he's all pure, then one becomes purified. So, impulses are born of the modes of material nature. One, a practicing devotee needs to recognize with detachment, here's this impulse, supposing, you know, anger or something, whatever, pick one off the shelf. Here's an impulse from the modes of nature. The same Maharaj Pariksit, he became overwhelmed with thirst. You know, being thirsty is not a problem. Becoming overwhelmed with thirst can be a problem. So we learn to tolerate the pushings of the modes of nature, the pushings of various urges, by fixing our consciousness upon the Supreme. And if it's appropriate to engage a certain impulse in Krishna's service, we can choose to do so or to choose not to do so. When that capacity becomes possible, when the consciousness is fixed upon the Supreme. Like a classic example of this is Hanuman. He exhibited anger. But he exhibited anger in service to Ram. He found Sita, and he decided, I want to teach these people a lesson, these Rakshasas a lesson. You've messed with the wrong person. Ram Chandra is going to come and destroy your place. So he exhibited anger. But it was in devotion to Krishna, or in devotion to Ram. There was transcendental anger. And as soon as the task of showing them a lesson was done, the anger was gone. It was purposeful and under control, not out of control. So that's the Hanuman platform, and we're not on the Hanuman platform. We're influenced by modes of nature. And I'll go back and say it again. Now, through knowledge, there's some protection. But knowledge alone is not enough. We can distance ourselves or detach ourselves from a mode of nature, an influence of the modes of nature, by knowledge. It's not us. It's the modes of nature. But that needs to be fortified or strengthened by devotion. When devotion is there, then the control doesn't just come from our own effort, it comes from Krishna empowering us to not act according to that impulse of the mode of nature, but act in a way that will be pleasing to Krishna instead. Then that's stronger. Light is stronger than darkness. So we need that strength of devotion to Krishna. We need Krishna's empowering us, Krishna Shakti. Yes. Knowledge and detachment is not a prerequisite for bhakti, but it sure helps. And if one doesn't have preliminary knowledge and detachment, Krishna can provide that. But then it becomes a transcendental knowledge and a transcendental detachment. Krishna advocates in Bhagavad Gita with the weapon of transcendental knowledge, cut this affinity for matter, and your reluctance to engage in your prescribed duty. Krishna is arming Arjuna, he's fortifying Arjuna with that endowment of transcendental knowledge. And with transcendental knowledge comes detachment. Kirtida, can you just sit down? Thanks. Just sit down. Thanks. Okay? We'll say it, same thing differently. Bhakti is independent. Bhakti is not dependent. The others are dependent. So, where there is knowledge or where there is detachment, the strength of them, the empowerment of them, the capacity of them comes from bhakti. Then they become very useful. They become instruments utilized by devotion. Bhakti, however, is not dependent upon them. You know, take Murghari as an example. What knowledge and detachment did he have? Zippo. But through the association of Narada, his devotion awakened. And thereby, naturally, knowledge and detachment came. So one doesn't have to be a highly educated person in order to become a devotee. Or the other way around. Because one is a highly educated person, naturally they're going to become a devotee. Neither are true. It's not a prerequisite. Or if one doesn't have it, a disqualifier. Okay, anything else?
I just have a question. Why don't people eat onion, garlic when they're following, when they become a devotee, they stop eating onion and garlic?
Okay. It has to do with the modes of nature. There are foods, according to Bhagavad Gita, that by their nature they promote the quality of goodness. Others by their nature they promote the quality of passion. Others by their nature they promote the quality of ignorance. So those foods which we are to offer to Krishna are foods in the quality of goodness. So although onions and garlic are in the vegetable categories, not meat, but it's not, doesn't promote the quality of goodness. It's not sattvic. And so we don't offer to Krishna anything that's not sattvic, and so we don't take that which is not offered to Krishna. We don't take onions and garlic. The effect upon the body is it aggravates passion and ignorance. So we don't take it. We don't offer it to Krishna. We don't take it. There are other foods that, other items that bring out flavor of foods that are of the quality of goodness. It promotes goodness. So we use those. Asafoetida and other things promote the quality of goodness. There's a little detail about this is there are some items that are also not taken because they're intoxicants. Like haritaki is an intoxicant. But in Ayurvedic medicine, haritaki is used as part of triphala that has a medicinal purpose. It's taken in a certain amount, not for taste or not for intoxication purposes, but in a smaller amount for a laxative purpose. Haritaki serves as that capacity. So when used in for specifically for medicinal purposes, it's not like offered to Krishna as food, you know, as bhoga to be offered in an offering to Krishna, but it's medicine. And when taken in that way and prescribed in that way, it's not prohibited. That's a detail. The principle is there are items that are in the quality of goodness and they promote the quality of goodness, and those are to be offered to Krishna and taken. Okay. We're done. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.